Hey, podcast listeners, we are currently looking for sponsors for this podcast. If you guys are looking to connect with other business owners that are scaling and growing their company, and you guys are interested in a spot on this podcast, we're looking for you. So reach out to ConnorTompkins.com or OperatorEquity.com, and we're glad to help set you guys up with a spot on this podcast. All right. Cheers. Back to the pod.
I don't think there's a single entrepreneur who's had success who didn't have years and years of like painstaking 20-hour days, crying in the bathroom. In those early stages, you think you're in this fishbowl, right? Every mistake is going to be just the biggest mistake. It's going to just be such a big blunder and derail your every dream you had. And you realize once you get through those things that like no one's even paying attention to you, it's a flash in the pan, a mistake, and you just move on and you're just wiser for it.
Hey, co-founders, welcome to Made It with Connor Tompkins, a podcast where we meet with badass entrepreneurs who've successfully exited their companies, discussing everything from the wins and losses of entrepreneurship to the next steps after the exit. To not miss out on these exciting stories, be sure to subscribe wherever you get podcasts. Let's dive in.
Hey, everyone, I'm here with Benji. He was a sales manager at Cohort, and then he started a New York venture community that led into Founder Shield, a insurance company for startups. And then he's also a part of his own family office, Interplay, and he's launching some new things that are coming around the bend. So I just want to say welcome, Benji. Good to have you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have your own podcast that's about to come out. It's called The Shit, help me.
The Schvitz. The Schvitz Sessions, yeah. Not The Shits. That's a different podcast. That's season two.
That's like whenever you're in there for too long. Yeah,
that's when things go, that's when things go real hard. Honestly, it falls in line with a lot of the other stuff I'm doing, but I enjoy the podcast format. I enjoy talking to people. I'm a extreme extrovert by nature. I love saunas. I love like new age wellness strategies and techniques. And it was incredibly impactful, especially post-exit for me. Because I went through like a very classic 1% problem of sold your company for a bunch of money and feeling lost and useless and imposter syndrome. And I was a therapist's wet dream, I think.
As soon as you exit, the therapists are like down the block just waiting for you.
Exactly. I was noticing that I would always have really interesting conversations in a sauna. You're definitely completely exposed in there. And number two, I think your heart's racing, you're sweating bullets, your mind's kind of starts to get a little loopy and you completely let loose. Or at least I've experienced that other people have like really let loose in those types of conversations. And the types of conversations that I've had with like super interesting, successful people have been very different from if I was just like at a meal with them or having a coffee with them. I thought to myself, it'd be really interesting to host a podcast or like a video, audio visual, YouTube channel podcast in which I'm talking to people that I find interesting and seeing where it goes and put the format inside of a sauna, which, you know, 190 degrees or higher. The goal is for the guest to last at least a certain amount of time.
It's like hot ones, but it's your entire body.
Exactly. Fully physical hot ones. The concept is that they're challenged or they're shamed if they can't beat the previous guest time. It's like a personal fantasy factory that I'm like creating over here with that or the other businesses I'm doing and just enjoying it. I think that the conversations that might come out of that are going to be really atypical, at least compared to a lot of other podcasts that are popular, that are out there, present company excluded. It's a social thought experiment for me to see what happens. The only goal I have around it is consistently put out content. I'm not marketing it. I don't care if anyone listens to it. The benefit is more so for myself and to be able to express like my artistic side, I think, in a handful of different ways and through a handful of different platforms.
I think that's a helpful way to look at it. And also the whole sauna idea. Are you just inviting people to be like, hey, you want a sauna with me?
Basically. I have a solid list of a couple hundred potential guests that I'm close with or some dream guests. And the idea is just to have them over. I built this sauna in my backyard. It was actually a much more complicated project than I initially anticipated because I had to rig the sauna so that it could basically double as a recording studio.
That's interesting. I have a hard time making this work just in an office, let alone the sauna. You know what I mean? Like, the audio's not working.
I have no idea if it's going to work. I have no idea if it's going to work. It's just going to be an iterative process, and we're going to have to figure it out. We rigged the inside with these heat-resistant, high-end GoPro cameras, and we saw, like, these mics from the ceiling with these heat-resistant covers on them. We'll see what the outcome of that is. I don't think audiophiles are going to be tuning in and enjoying it. It's something that I personally am excited about, just sitting down in there with someone. And there's this mental hurdle and challenge that when you are in a sauna with someone else, you create this bond around this communal experience. It's the same thing with starting a company, going through those challenges. The bond and the relationship and the level of depth in that relationship when you experience something challenging together, I think is really unique and special. And so trying to flash in the pan, create that over and over again and see what happens.
Yeah, you're in the schvitz together, right? You're in the thick of it.
Exactly. We're going to have a cold plunge outside as well. So
I was like, as long as you can jump into something cold after that, that would feel great.
Yeah. So I might have a second segment that's 3 minute quick questions in the cold plunge, right?
I have to ask you really quick, because I know that you're jumping into podcast life now. For those that don't know you, how did you go from being a sales manager to starting a company and Founder Shield?
Yeah. The high level story of that goes, I was the junior business development salesperson on this early stage venture backed company called Cohort. This was in, I'll call it end of 2010, early 2011. We raised $3 million. My boss said, Benji, you deal with insurance because we're busy. Yeah, sure, I can handle it. I was a go-getter. I figured, low man on the totem pole, say yes and figure out how to accomplish the goal afterwards. And I just remember that the experience of finding a broker, going through the process of buying commercial insurance, how debilitating it felt and how antiquated and archaic that entire process was. And I was so inundated in the technology world or in the startup world. I was just blown away by how little tech was being used or no tech was being used as related to commercial insurance. We had such a hard time getting insurance because in the insurance industry as a whole had very little faith in venture-backed businesses and early stage startups at that time. And the way they thought about those companies did not fit into what their traditional underwriting guidelines looked like. And so companies like ours just had a difficult time, were overpaying for insurance. And that was just on top of how time consuming and how archaic the whole process was. Logged that painful experience in the back of my head. And as the next kind of year went on, pushed it aside, forgot about it, but probably towards the beginning or middle of 20, writing was on the wall that the company I was working at was not going to raise any more money. They were going to go under. They hadn't achieved product market fit yet. And I was thinking about what I wanted to do next and was talking to a mentor of mine. We got to the point where I realized all I really wanted to do was anything around sales, right? I absolutely am obsessed, I'm addicted to the science of sales, the strategies behind sales. I would have always loved to be a professional athlete, but unfortunately didn't have the height or athletic ability to be able to ever get there. And so sales is, in my mind, is the kind of perfect antidote for that, right? There's so many parallels between sales and sports and athleticism that I was just drawn to it. And so as I was going through that process, I thought back to that experience about buying insurance. And I guess I was either overly confident or I guess properly confident. I'm not sure. Jury's still out. But that if businesses buy insurance, I can convince them to buy it from me.
Benji, that's a really hard industry to get into. I feel like it has a built-in moat because even whenever I think about insurance, my mind goes blank.
I was tempted to talk about it many times from a handful of different people. A lot of people told me that you can't just start an insurance brokerage or an insurance company.
Yeah.
You need X number of years of experience. You need all of this knowledge.
I guess they weren't right, or they were.
No, they were definitely wrong. I think that there are significant benefits to not having any sort of experience in an industry before you try and disrupt that industry.
Yeah.
You don't have the perspective of your prior experience in that industry and using that as a way to try and achieve success in the industry. for me, I looked at FounderShield not as, oh, here's how we are going to disrupt insurance, because I didn't even know what it meant to disrupt insurance outside of digitizing the process. I really thought of it, and I was inspired by the Tony Hsieh book.
Oh, the one on customer experience.
I think it's called Delivering Happiness, something along those lines. One quote really stuck out to me in that book, which is Tony Hsieh is talking about the fact that he doesn't even like shoes. He owns 2 or 3 pairs of shoes. And he gets into this whole conversation about Zappos is not a shoe company, right? Shoes are just a means to what they're really delivering, which is extreme levels of happiness and extreme levels of pleasure and excitement. And the vehicle in which they do that through happens to be through shoes. And so I thought of that and I said, you know what? The challenge I put to myself was, shoes are great. It's like a gift to yourself. They're nice. Imagine if you could deliver some sort of positive vibe, some sort of happiness around something that people push off, dread doing, which is buying insurance. It's like a necessary evil that people just have to deal with. Imagine if you can achieve like some level of excitement or happiness. Or in my dreams, I was thinking that, what if people were excited to get on the phone with us?
I'm trying to imagine a happy experience and I'm struggling here.
How did we pull it off? I think it was extreme levels of attentiveness towards like customer service and customer support and really getting into the mind of our customers and understanding what their pain points are and understanding what their stress levels were at any given point in time and how we could be a value add to their ultimate goal, which is to achieve whatever dream or level of success they had built up for their company. And so if we can be a vehicle that allows them to even increase the odds of achieving their dream by 0.01%, we'd be accomplishing our goal.
So Benji, you ended up selling this for 9 figures. What were the inputs? Did you have co-founders? Did you raise rounds of investment?
Yeah, I had a co-founder. We bootstrapped the whole time, never raised a penny. And it was very difficult, but a very thankful and very strategic decision not to raise capital. And a old mentor of mine I definitely give credit to him for pushing that thought in our head. And even as we were getting interest from a lot of funds, he kept on telling us, just grow at your own pace. It's a lesson that I've taken on as I'm advising other startups, as I'm on to like my next thing. It was the most important decision, and it definitely was a key reason that led to the success we had and the ultimate exit that we had. We had to really be confident in our internal investments, where we were going to put our money to work. It ended up making us much better, smarter decision makers and making the right decision more often than not. And I think if we were in a position where we had a ton of cash and a ton of runway to make mistakes, we didn't really have that flexibility. It allowed us to achieve an exit that was really unique in our industry, because we were both a profitable company and a high growth 100% year over year company over almost a decade, and a company that over that decade of time had developed and built a lot of proprietary technology. And so the combination of all of those things allowed us to have like access to a really large pool of interested acquirers, which I think ultimately led to the exit multiple that we ended up achieving.
There's not so many people in the space. So if I was an insurance company and I was looking at potential acquisitions, it's not e-commerce, right? You have a very slim set of options.
Typically for most strategic acquirers and most insurance companies, larger insurance companies, there's minimal organic growth year over year, especially once they hit a certain size. And most of their growth is attributed to strategic acquisitions. And there's a pretty active M&A market, but it's mostly traditional insurance brokerages buying smaller traditional insurance brokers and basically utilizing their book of business, book of revenue to determine the acquisition value.
You're definitely solving a pain point. We're both part of this group where a bunch of other founders talk about issues that they're facing. And did you see that thread on insurance? It's on the personal side. So even though it's not like on the company side, even though it did touch on that, it's all these people that have had massive insurance plans before, and yet they're still scratching their head about, oh, how do I go to the doctor's office? Which is funny to think about.
It's wild. The truth is we had many opportunities to dip our toes and dive into the personal line side and the health insurance side as well. And we were very strategic in not allowing ourselves to go in that direction and trying to expand our TAM that way. But that was mostly because the sales organization we had built up internally, the skills they had and the way we had trained them was really focused on their ability to sell into companies, which is a very different kind of path and strategy that needs to get utilized versus selling it to individuals. You're dealing with a much more emotional buyer when you're dealing with personal insurance than you are with commercial insurance. It's just a different set of tools that are required in order to, I think, achieve the level of success I would have wanted to achieve in that area.
On your website somewhere, I saw that you were talking about like your proliferation into the VC marketplace. Is that part of your go-to-market, is you would go to VC companies and just be like, hey, we can cover your entire portfolio, essentially?
When we first started the company, September, October 2012, I made sure to brand our business as insurance for startups. That was like the initial tagline. And the reason why we did that was because we knew that at that point, there were no other insurance brokerages that focused on startups. And on top of that, we were confident that even if there was a competing larger insurance brokerage, one with more experience, who could say, oh yeah, we work with high growth companies or startups, they wouldn't be able to say they exclusively work with startups.
Right, yeah.
And be able to market that, like, hey, this is all we do, all we know. We're super like narrow, deep, and not wide area of expertise. And I think that allowed us to develop a level of comfort between us and our prospective buyers.
We did something similar, like we were outsourcing for startups. And then they grew, we grew. It was like, yeah, they might be like a Y Combinator company and they just got funding. And then eventually they ramp up to hundreds of people and you're just along for the ride.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Some of our early clients, and then we rode the wave with them, were like Coinbase, Robinhood, two like pretty monumental clients that we had worked with.
We were working with Coinbase too in the early days. Yeah, people were getting paid in like cryptocurrency. And we're like, oh, okay, that's cool.
So I met with Fred and Brian and we were just shooting the shit, talking about the standard types of insurance that they needed, D&O insurance, GL for their office, property, all of those kind of basic insurance needs. And I remember I'd asked him, I said, I'm not a crypto expert. I can't even buy crypto yet because this is like early 2013. In New York, you couldn't really buy it. I said, I'm like, but I can imagine a scenario where people have a significant percentage of their net worth or a meaningful amount of their capital sitting in on your servers and on your platform. And I told them, I was like, I think we could potentially do what a company like a PayPal does, or even like an FDIC for banks. We could probably promote and market the fact that Coinbase, that any deposits in Coinbase are fully insured and backed by Lloyd's of London or a legitimate insurance provider. And especially at that time, we're like, crypto was at its infancy and there was so much fear around the unknown.
And I mean, look at FTX and this stuff.
Yeah, I remember when Mt. Gox happened, which was I think 2014 maybe. That almost derailed this entire concept. We basically worked really closely with Fred and Brian and ended up developing the first ever insurance product for cryptocurrency.
Oh, that's awesome.
End up getting up to, I think it was like $1 billion in capacity in that like initial structure. And Fred and I, we must have flown to London 1,000 times to meet with. Fred had to literally teach blockchain technology and crypto to 50 different heads of different Lloyd's syndicates, all white-haired, middle-aged men.
You're like, you send the money where? Like, where does it go?
Exactly. And then they're like middle-aged, proper British men who at first we're like, I'm like, this is never, they're never going to understand this.
How did you get them to sign off on that? Now that seems a little bit of a stretch.
I don't think I was overly strategic. I think I was just absolutely relentless.
Yeah.
I'm going to make it happen. I have this tendency to overpromise and then do everything possible to deliver on that promise. Sometimes it's bitten me in the ass, but in this situation, it worked out well.
You're working backwards. You're like, this is going to happen. And you're like, how are we going to do this?
I can't get away from that. Even to this day, I still do that. And it's just, I think it might be just the way I motivate myself and the way I guess I work best. I like to be thrown into the fire, and sink or swim experience and mentality is beneficial to me, I think. maybe I'm just a masochist. But anyways, that experience with Coinbase led us down this path where we realized that there was this whole nother opportunity to not just be a tech-enabled, tech-automated commercial insurance brokerage, but to be a truly tech-enabled, vertically integrated insurance experience. We realized that we could go down this path where we could not only create a really optimal customer experience from the broker's side of things, but we felt like we could get to a point to achieve what we believed was like the ultimate goal, which is fully own the entire process A to Z, because that's the only way you can truly create custom specialized experience for your clients. And so that was the path that we went down, and that really unlocked a lot of growth for us and a lot of innovation that ultimately led to our exit.
You were there for 11 years. So it was like an overnight success that took 11 years to build and launch.
Yeah, exactly. So every founder I know has, from the external point of view, overnight made it big. And I don't think there's a single entrepreneur I knew who's had success who didn't have years and years of like painstaking 20-hour days, crying in the bathroom. I've lost count of the number of times that's happened to me, but most people don't see that side of it. And honestly, the truth is that's the beauty of being an entrepreneur. And I think once you get through the other side, you realize it is that in those early stages, you think you're in this fishbowl, right? You think that every mistake is going to be just the biggest mistake. It's going to just be such a big blunder and derail your every dream you had. It's life or death. And then you realize, you know, once you get through those things that like no one's even paying attention to you and people, it's a flash in the pan of a mistake and you just move on and you're just wiser for it.
I think I realized I could take a lot more punches than I thought I could. And the company could take a lot more punches than like, it feels like the end of days, but it's not quite. We had like an earthquake take out our office and we're like, oh, what are we going to do now? And then we had offices in the Philippines and there was like a typhoon like every season and the pandemic was like a military style quarantine and we're like, we have people on site. What do we do with all these like computers? Some people can't get home because they like literally blocked off the highways and you're like, we'll figure it out. And you do.
It's your only choice. And I think it's for anyone who thinks this is the road towards an exit or whenever your ultimate goal is as an entrepreneur is just paved with butterflies and rainbows. It is not the case. There are just as many, I think, if not more down days than there are like super positive up days. And I think the best entrepreneurs just have that like superpower to be so resilient in the face of that and be able to like forget it. It reminds me of, I can't remember who it is. I know it definitely applies to like Steph Curry, which is any good shooter in the NBA. Basically, if they miss 10 shots, they think the 11th shot is going in, right? And they're like, and they constantly are forgetting about their last miss. It's over. It's done. On to the next.
That's our superpowers. We can't remember.
Exactly. We're like, I don't know.
A Mayfly or something.
Dory in Finding Nemo. I got three little kids. So my Disney references are very on point right now.
I do think that there's probably easier paths to entrepreneurship than like what we went through probably. Buying a business is probably an easier way to get into it. And there's pre-established processes. I feel like there's an easier way. There has to be an easier way.
I don't know. I bought a business now. I've went through another M&A deal that ended up just burning up and into flames in the 11th hour. We're in LOI on another one right now. And so I don't think it's easier. I think it's just a different set of challenges. I also think it's different depending on what your mindset is and your objectives are going in. I like personally can't, like I'm so bad at looking at a target acquisition or a business and saying, okay, this is a really good investment. Just keep the ship steady, like incremental changes over time. I'm like, no, let's blow this up and turn this into the biggest thing and whatever. It doesn't even matter what industry. It could be in like adult diapers. I'd be like, we're revolutionizing adult diapers. For me, at least that mindset has been helpful because having like insane, absurd dreams and ones that are, I think, from an external perspective, like shocking or laughable, create like a certain amount of motivation and eagerness to prove people wrong. that I personally find exhilarating. And I also think that if you shoot for the moon, right, you fall in the stars, right? Whatever you end up doing and succeeding with, even if it's not that like outlandish dream, it's way further along that path than if you just had a very reasonable, strategic, achievable dream on an annual basis.
I keep on bouncing back and forth between like reasonable and not reasonable. So yeah, we're going to revamp this entire industry. And then I'm like disappointed. I'm like, why isn't it revamped yet? But on the other hand, you're moving forward and you're getting tens of millions of dollars in revenue, and that's falling. That's pretty good. Like, that's a win.
It's great. I think different entrepreneurs love different stages of a startup life. Like for me, I love like the 0 to 1. I call maybe 0 to 1, 1 to 2, where it's an unlimited amount of chaos and you are forced to make decisions with one hand tied behind your back and operating on a lot of intuition and gut. I love wearing multiple hats and having a small team and creating like a really unique culture and putting together like a dream that feels misguided on some level. I love that side. Once a business gets to a point where, you know, it's steady, it's repeatable, 9 times out of 10, once a company hits that stage, people like shift their mindset to, okay, don't fuck this up now.
That's more like a save what you have and expand, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm like. That's for me personally, I get a lot less motivated at that stage.
I think I like the 0 to 1, and then I can skip 1 to 2, and then 2 to 3. I'll be happy.
Yeah.
You can start up a landing page. You can build the initial team. You can bring in the first X million in revenue and get it going. And then there's the awkward like middle stage. Like I'm going to call it the adolescent teenager, where like things are uncomfortable and you don't quite have experts in all the positions. And then I'll come back and I'll be excited whenever I have all my seats filled with fantastic people that are really know their shit and are kicking ass in each area. And then I feel like they're like amplifying each of the different segments. But I think that I don't even know if 2 to 3 is part of the saying.
We're entrepreneurs. We're creating our own paths on a continuous basis.
We need to tell Peter Thiel about the 0 to 1, 1 to 2, 2 to 3. There's more to it.
We do that and we get juiced on steroids with him.
I don't know, Peter, if you're watching this, you need to get into a sauna and say hi to Benji.
We'll happily take sponsorship dollars from the voided up Olympic Games that he's starting.
It sounds amazing. I want to see athletes just destroy like previous records with performance enhancing drugs.
That's basically like what American Gladiator was like trying to do in like the early 90s, turning it into an Olympic level competition. It will definitely be interesting.
Like as long as it's, how do you say safe? Like how do you put performance enhancing to a point? Or else doesn't that get problematic?
They haven't provided enough details there. I assume it's like to some certain levels.
If you go too far, you have roided up anger issues happening on the track. You know, you're like, hey, focus.
Maybe that's part of the competition. It's boxing and track and field together.
We should talk about what... So tell me about the exit. What was that like for you and what are you looking to do next?
Such a unique and grueling and just exhausting and rewarding experience. It was just it was every possible emotion all rolled up together. The way we ended up selling, because we were bootstrapped, we didn't have any pressure to sell or anything like that. We weren't trying to reach some sort of valuation and raise another round. We didn't have any sort of time pressure on us, but we had to end up getting 2 like unsolicited LOIs in December of 2020.
Okay.
And they were interesting enough from a total dollar standpoint. They were like, okay, shit, this is what people are willing to pay for us. This is crazy. We ended up interviewing a handful of investment bankers, settled on one, and then just did the gauntlet. 6-7 months, we had 77 first round meetings. And we had this scenario where we had interest in a lot of different acquirers, investors. Went 4 paths. Went down the path of a SPAC, considered it. Went down the path of private equity. Went down the path of growth fund and kind of raising our first round, but like a massive one. And then we went down the strategic path. Through that process, I remember it was COVID time, so it was still in the stages where people weren't really traveling. Our bankers, for the first probably like month, we did like dry runs and just like practicing the pitch. There's a different strategy when you're pitching a client versus when you're pitching
someone who's looking to buy you, right? You're dealing with a different set of goals or incentives and have to be a chameleon in a different way as it relates to those pitches. Had key points, and we were talking, I think it was like 2 or 3 meetings a day, an hour and a half each. It sucked. It was just absolutely exhausting. It broke me countless times. I had so much doubt during it. I'm like, we're not going to sell. And I'm lying to my employees. I wasn't lying, but I'm like, I can't communicate with
it. You have to keep it to yourself, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. And I'm like, but they know something's up because I'm not as involved or attentive to their needs. It was just absolutely grueling. I wake up in the middle of the night, just like sweaty bullets, thinking like, oh my God, I messed up that pitch a week ago. But I guess there's some type of level of resilience. We ended up pushing through that, getting to that next round. I think we had 10 or 11 LOIs all said and done. I think part of it was that we were a unique company in the sense that like we were a high growth tech company with a bunch of proprietary technology. And we had really healthy, like kind of venture level organic growth year over year. And we were profitable every year that we operated.
Like 20% growth, 20% EBITDA or something like that. Like you were blowing out the growth target.
We did not plan it this way, but we went through this M&A process. I couldn't have picked a more perfect time. It basically started right as that like initial level of fear of COVID was dissipating and confidence in the market started to increase a little bit. And there had been so much like dry capital ready to be deployed because no one did anything for 9 months.
Yeah.
The market was just like foaming at the mouth, waiting, like needing to make acquisitions. And so we came in just at an absolute perfect time and end up selling to a company called BRP, and the rest is history.
Congratulations, man. That's awesome. Running a process is not fun at all. I think I talked to 22 different bankers and brokers to try to figure out how to take us to market.
It is a lot of people and it's an interesting process. Your bankers are your best friends until you sign the LOI with the company you tend to sell to. And then they basically can't be trusted at that point.
They're like just trying to push through the deal.
Ignore that. No, we're not going to push here. Otherwise, it was like, no, we can't push on these terms. They're going to shut the deal down. I'm telling you. And my next exit, if I ever am that insane to go down that path again, I will definitely not hold any punches or requests because I think we could have been able to be even more aggressive than we were.
I hear a lot from bankers and brokers. They're like, just think about the overall pie or just think about the big picture. And you're just like, oh man, I'm just trying to get this through. Potentially, depending on if there's an earnout or not, this might be my life for the next 2 years. It's important to get the right terms in the first place. You're starting a family office / almost like a venture studio. It's like a combination of both, right?
The initial idea was just like set these vehicles up, like from a tax saving standpoint and just proper financial structures, setting it up. And as I finished up that first layer of like legal work, I was trying to figure out what the strategy was and what I wanted to do next. Initially, I considered not doing anything forever. I think my financial advisor would have preferred that.
Yeah, we would make more money if we did nothing.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. It's I'm definitely not looking to get political, but it doesn't matter to me. But there's always these different articles about Trump and how if he had never done anything based on his inheritance, he'd be worth like a significant multiple more than he is now.
We'll be missing out on Trump steaks. And Trump Academy and shoes. Yeah, the world would be missing these things.
But honestly, I can't relate to a lot with him, but I can definitely relate to that asset, which is it's at that point, it's not about the accumulation of wealth. It's you feel dead inside if you're not like pursuing those things that you're passionate about, regardless of whether that exposes you to certain levels of financial risk.
Did you have an identity crisis a little bit, like after that?
God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, me
identity
too.
Crisis, depression.
What do I tell people whenever I meet them at dinner? What do you do? I'm like, I'm just living.
I would always mix it up. I'd be like, sometimes I'd say I'd retire. Sometimes I would say I'm a stay-at-home dad. Sometimes I'd tell the truth. Whatever I said, I was uncomfortable with saying.
Yeah, just different answer each time. What do you do? I watch Finding Nemo like a few times a day, and I hang out with my kids and... Just have a different answer every time they ask.
definitely didn't know how to navigate it. It's like one of those things, I don't even know how, can't really prepare for it, right?
I told myself, don't let your identity get wrapped up in this thing. Like, it's not going to last forever. It's a sandcastle, right? The tide's going to come out at some point. And yeah, and my identity, so it totally got wrapped up in it. And yeah, I, even though I saw it coming, I couldn't do anything about it.
For a decade, basically, my brain was in this like very like unique fight or flight mode. And so I basically was in this survival mode where anything that would distract me from achieving my goals from as it related to founders from that business, it basically just got pushed off to the side, right? It basically just didn't hit my, I don't know, frontal cortex or whatever part of the brain it was going to hit. And very soon after we sold, it's almost as if like everything opened up in my head and like it had room for other thoughts. And I started thinking about things that I was like, I haven't thought about this ever. And then I didn't have answers. And I was prepared to deal with those questions and thoughts and identity crisis and all of that. And instead of being prepared for that, it was more so I just had to pick up the pieces and put them back together afterwards.
I was like, I need a vehicle for whatever's next. So like I did operator equity, which is like the operators and entrepreneurs are like the LPs and like the funds, and you acquire a company and then you guys can do joint deals together in the future. And so I started buying companies, and then I started doing passion projects, right? I'm expanding a lot more. Instead of just doing one thing, I'm doing a bunch of different things. So tell me a little bit about what you're doing on that side with your family office, and what company did you end up buying? Are you planning on buying more?
The path that I ended up choosing to go down from like a family office strategy after trial and error was I got to a point where I realized I'm an operator and I'm like a risk taker and disruptive by nature, and putting myself in those positions and in those experiences is what excites me. And so I really shifted focus from a family office strategy completely away from any sort of passive investments. I basically told my financial advisor, like, they're in charge of the passive investments. I get no excitement out of it at all whatsoever. For an angel investment I made, because I think the first, I'd been making angel investments, and definitely the first 18 months post-exit, I went like real crazy on angel investments. But I just had this one company that I had an angel investment in that exited for $750 million around. Like, that was a company that I invested, I think it was at like a $3.5 million valuation.
Oh, wow.
And the only enjoyment I get out of it is that I know the founder, I know how hard he worked, and he's like the embodiment of like persistence and grit and resilience. And I'm excited for him. There's no joy out of it for me, because I didn't do anything. I finally realized, I'm like, okay, I have to do stuff. Otherwise, like, it's just going to be an unenjoyable dragging my feet through the mud process. And so structured the family office where we only focus on building new companies and majority stake or 100% takeover acquisition. The second thing that I'm in this position now where I started Founder Shield and Scale Underwriting when I was 24. I was engaged. I wasn't married yet. Didn't have kids. And by the time we sold in 2021, my oldest was 4 at the time. And now I have 3 kids, and they never have really seen me work at the like early beginning stage entrepreneurial level that consumed so much of my life and that I was proud of and yielded the results that we ended up achieving. And I really wanted them to like see that firsthand. I felt like it was the best way for me to teach them those lessons and those values, because those like soft skills that I think make the difference between good and great for an entrepreneur, they're hard to teach. And I thought the best way that I could do it for them was just by being the embodiment of that and living that life.
Yeah.
And so really, that was really important to me. And then on top of that, I really just wanted to get my feet wet into a bunch of different things that I had no experience in and no business being in. And I wanted to start do things that were polar opposite of what I had been doing and things that were more tangible. Because I felt that on top of the trying to be like an example of hard work for my kids. I also thought that it would be so much more exciting for them to witness, like, from infancy, from a seedling idea through whatever the ultimate goal is, of something like truly tangible and something that they can experience firsthand.
Benji, is this going to be the Paddle United Sports Club that you're launching?
There are two things. Paddle United Sports Club, that was the one we're launching. And then I also bought another, is a indoor 20,000 square foot, like, franchisor sort of path of growth, kids facility, sports facility, summer camps, things like that. It makes a ton of money. I honestly didn't know anything about this industry. Someone introduced me to the former owner of it. It was something that I'm like, oh, this is really interesting from just a profit center standpoint. And they don't use any tech. It's like, they almost are like treating it like a real estate play, in the sense of it exists, they make money, and that's it.
Yeah, and you can just hold on to it forever.
Which obviously is not what I'm doing. I'm like, okay, how do we revolutionize the
the indoor sports game?
The indoor birthday party industry. Both of those businesses are ones that, like, I now bring my kids to. I show them, hey, this is the change we're making. Hey, and my oldest son, who's gonna be 8, like, I asked him for, like, his input on this Superdome business. I told him, I was like, you're the target demo. What is it that you want here? What would be the perfect birthday party here? What would be, like, the coolest arcades that we should put in here? And so it's really exciting to have this different sort of entrepreneurial and startup path and journey, in which I can share in that experience with my kids.
I have a fascination for secret rooms.
So if you happen to put any secret rooms in that thing, I will check it out.
I'll figure it out. Secret rooms are not necessarily the best way to maximize utilization, but maybe I'll put my office behind a secret room in
a bookshelf or something like that.
Yeah, in Padel United. Yeah, and then, like, the Padel thing.
Oh yeah, tell me about Padel.
I think going through, like, the mental low points and struggles post-exit, one thing that really got me through it was basically being super aggressive in trying anything and everything from a wellness standpoint. And I got super into cold plunging and cryo and saunaing, red light therapy as well, even some sensory deprivation tank stuff. And so it really had such a net positive impact on my life. And I was traveling to all these places to try and do these things, because the town that I live in, area I live in Jersey, they just didn't have any of these spots around. And so I was like, you know what? I'm just going to buy all of this stuff and put it in my backyard or somewhere in my house and make my own little wellness retreat in my home. And my financial advisor called me up, like, Benji, you're an idiot. Stop doing this. Get a retail location and put all that stuff there and go there for it. Even if it's just for you, go there for it. But don't, like, waste money doing this in your own house.
Like, yeah, it could be a business. Or was he seeing it more as, like, a tax, like, thing?
Yeah,
it was
a bit. Yeah.
Or both. Like,
for both. But mostly he's like, you can, even if the business fails, it's still a business expense if you try and attempt to make it into a business.
Yeah.
And so I said, I'm like, okay, you know what? I really wanted a kind of, like, a social wellness club in my town. I thought, like, this area of Jersey, which is, it's affluent, it's beautiful homes, upper middle class or upper class suburban towns and neighborhoods. I was like, there's nothing here really that provides that sort of offering. So as I was going through that process looking for it, I'd also at the same time I'd been introduced to Padel, and I was fascinated less by the sport necessarily and more so by, like, the hockey stick, like, growth metrics it was showing, and the, like, the financial analysis and unit economics of that business. Because unlike tennis, Padel requires significantly less square footage, and it's 4 players instead of 2 players. So
yeah,
you basically have a 2.5x plus another 2x on top of that potential earnings per comparative square footage between Padel and tennis. And so I knew that racket sports in general were, like, super popular in this area. And I knew that there was, like, a lack of supply and a massive demand for indoor facilities. I could combine those two ideas, the Padel side, which is social at its core, and, like, a social wellness club, we might be able to create something like really special and really unique.
This is really cool. I'm looking at a graph looking at growth of like global sales of padel rackets, and
like these stats are old too. So it's looking at 83,000 in 2002 to 409,000 in 2017. And oddly, Spain and Argentina have the most at this point.
Sweden has a bunch, Norway. It started in Mexico. Spain is where it really took off. Now it's the second most popular recreational sport behind soccer in Spain. There's okay. around 8 million active weekly recreational players in Spain. It grown exponentially in the UAE, Dubai, Qatar, all over the Middle East. I would say in the past probably 36 months, we've started to see a significant increase in interest and then investment in both the UK and in the US. And there's a lot of very wealthy individuals and funds pouring, and athletes, celebrities pouring a ton of capital into the growth of the sport in the US. And it's really fascinating because right now, as we currently stand, there are less than, I think, 400 public padel courts available in the US. And it's the demand and the chatter around it far outweighs the supply. Like, there's a massive supply issue here. So there's a massive push to increase that supply tenfold over the next couple of years to be able to support the demand. In my opinion, it has all the benefits of a sport like pickleball, which obviously became massive in the States, but it isn't played anywhere else, by the way. And so it has all the growth potential and the benefits of pickleball in the sense that I think the best thing about pickleball is that anyone can really take it up. It's very easy to take up. There's not a big learning curve other than their confusing scoring system. And padel is very similar from that standpoint. It's really easy to pick up. The difference between the two is that padel is like chess in that it requires a different level of strategy and a never-ending pursuit of growth in your skills and your strategies and in becoming a better player. And it also requires a different level of athleticism. So it requires a lot more agility. It's a better workout. You're breaking a significant sweat. And real athletes, like professional padel players, are like incredible athletes who are on the same level to like athletes in a lot of other sports, just from the athletic ability. And it's one of those sports where I believe by in 2032, it's going to be introduced into the Olympics.
Of course, Andy, is this a franchise or is this something that you just came up with? And
we just came up with it.
Okay, cool. If it does turn into a franchise, then let me know.
Yeah, I can't see it being a franchise business, especially like the strategy there is like it's very amenity rich, like luxury for kind of a country club vibe.
Yeah, I'm looking at this. So, you have cryotherapy. You're looking at premium cafes and juice bar, children's play area. Actually, the children's play area is pretty sweet.
That was an important thing, I think, because our strategy is very much focused on what I think is, it's even less about padel and wellness. It's really about what I believe is like the core issue that like I'm trying to solve for, which is why you saw this in like during COVID, post-COVID, where a tremendous amount of wealth and millennials moved outside of like large metropolitan cities, moved into the suburbs. And there's just a lack of like unique, special, transformative, like retail experiences in the burbs.
There's this idea of a third place, right? And suburbs are missing that. And exactly. The third place, for those that don't know, is it's not your home, it's not your office, it's what used to be the bar or the club or the lounge, and we don't have that in the burbs.
Exactly. It's some place to like to recharge, to escape, and to be like communal, right? To meet new people. I think that's one of the things, the difficulties of being in the burbs. I came from New York City before this. Unlike the city where you're constantly meeting people all the time, especially post-exit, I found myself like, oh, I've basically been in my house. And so really just I'm meeting the people that I'm already friends with, but not really experiencing meeting new people and being exposed to new ideas, new personality types, all the stuff that makes life worth living.
Have you heard of the garage in Park City? It's supercar storage artwork, but it's a third place, right? You're bringing people together and you're making friends that have common interests or slightly different interests. if you can solve, particularly grown men past the age of 30, making new friends, you solved a major issue in America.
I think padel really lends itself to that because it's a two-on-two sport and your community organizing is a core area where you have to succeed in order to build a successful padel club. And the reason for that is, for the most part, it's hard to find three other people all the same time who can play. Unlike tennis, you can find one person to play with. But in this situation, the goal is, you want to play, we'll have three other people like to play with, introduce you to, all of that. And you know, I think like Remedy Place has done a really good job of the social wellness side, on like the true wellness kind of retail experience, right? Or club experience, where they've made cold plunges, and Othership is another one in Brooklyn that's done the same thing, where they've made cold plunges and sauna a more communal experience, right?
Former Soviet Union places that used to be like the banya. Did you ever go out to like the bathhouse?
I love the Russian bathhouses. The Turkish bathhouses. Those are fantastic. In the city, that's where I used to go. They didn't have these sort of like newer, luxurious saunas. It was always these in shambles. They looked like they were 500 years old with 80-year-old naked Russian men.
That's how you want it. That's the authentic experience.
I only can hope and dream that one day we can have just a bunch of naked old Russian men just chilling in the sauna. That's the dream.
That's the dream. Yeah. My wife is Belarusian, so that country like on the corner of Ukraine and Russia. And we went to go visit her family in Minsk, and they got in their head of, oh, we're going to give Connor the American, a true banya Russian experience. And I'm like, okay, cool. And they found this place online. We get in this cab and it's snowing and he's going up the mountain. And I see do not enter signs. And this cabbie just doesn't give a heck. Like he's just going, like he's off-roading, going up this mountain, past these signs. And we get to like this warehouse, like this kind of like compound kind of thing. And it has a guard thing at the front, and it has two German shepherds chained up, and it looks like a Fast and Furious kind of like safe house. And you're like, okay, cool. Like this is a banya. This is supposed to be like a bathhouse authentic experience. And this big old guy, completely bald, comes out in like a robe in the snow, like wearing nothing else. And he's like, yeah, come here. I'm like, all right, where are we going? Is this going to be safe? And the family's like, all right, let's go. They go inside. There's like locker rooms. And we get undressed and they do the thing, and they're like, let's like give Connor like the authentic experience. And like, do you know the birch sticks?
Oh yeah. I've done it all.
You've done the whole thing. You're a pro. Yeah.
I am the future host of a sauna podcast, the first of its kind. So
oh my gosh, if you hit your guests with the birch sticks to push the heat.
Exactly. Patreon. I don't know. We'll figure it out.
Whenever they took me to this place, they have the big guy. They're like bringing the big guy. Yeah. So this big guy comes in with the sticks and he starts doing it to me. And I'm like, oh, I'm terrified. And then he jumps and does the most beautiful swan dive into the cold plunge I've ever seen a big man do, barely like a ripple. And he's like, come here. And I'm like, I'm not sure if I want to do this. And he's like, no, come here. And so I jump in, and then he cradles me and rocks me around in a slow circle. And he's relaxed, and I'm like stiff. I'm like, I can't move. And that was my authentic Russian banya experience.
Here's the beauty about all that stuff, right? The like community interaction, meeting new people, I think is so important. And I think the other part is, I don't think we like as a society, or at least as Americans, I don't think we like expose ourselves to challenges and failure as much as we really should, as much as is healthy for us. Because I think that there's a certain experience and feeling you get when you overcome an obstacle, when you put yourself in a challenging position or a challenging situation where success is not guaranteed. And you come out of that the other side, right? You come out of it alive, whether you succeed or fail, right? Failure and success are all relative. But yeah, hopefully, exactly. But it's so crucial to like the human experience.
I like that tradition where like once a year you pick a major challenge to push yourself. Is that called something?
There's a Japanese term for it. It's so funny. I just read a book like, it must have been like a month ago, about this exact thing.
We need to figure out the name for this thing though. There's definitely a name for it. Hey Benji, we are at time. How should people find you?
How should people find me? Please don't.
Please don't. It does not exist.
Just don't look for me. Don't find me. No. I don't know. People find me. I don't know. Google my name. I'm not sure. Go to LinkedIn. I'm not big on X or anything else like that.
Check out Padel United Sports Club.
Yeah, padelunitedsportsclub.com. And then you also have The Schvitz, which is coming out, which is a secret podcast. Yes. And if you find it, then you're lucky.
I hope no one ever listens to it. I hope I do it for the next 10 years. I hope I get to 1,000 episodes of it. And I hope the only person, I probably will never listen to it because I disdain listening to myself or watching myself in an interview or TV. So I can almost guarantee that I will not be a listener of the podcast. So no one else listen to it. Please don't. You won't know where to find it.
There's nothing you could say that would make this blow up more. Please do not find this. This is a secret. It's just for me, and it's on the internet for everyone else to see.
Listen, if you're into me interviewing Mark Cuban, Nips blasting, then it's for you.
Yeah, see, that's the sell side of you. Like, you so sold. That's that's definitely a sell.
I guess so. I don't know. Yeah, I can't help it.
Benji, but I appreciate the chat, and we'll be in touch.
Pleasure.
Yeah, all right, cool. Likewise. Good to see you.
That wraps up today's episode. For more inspiring stories and valuable lessons from successful entrepreneurs, be sure to listen and subscribe wherever you get podcasts. Thanks for listening. Until next time, keep pushing boundaries and writing your next chapter.